Today is November 27th. It's 2015. It's Kristen McQuarrie's sister's birthday.
Kelly, yes.
Kelly. Shout out to Kelly. Shout out to my wife, Brenda. Today's our anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
Happy day after Thanksgiving to you. This is John Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals with me, John Williams, and Kristen McQuarrie, columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. Eric Zorn and Steve Bertrand normally join us for this segment. They are on holiday, as they would say in Europe. And so we will present this edition of Mincing Rascals with just the two of us. And there's only one topic that we have to talk about and we'll focus on today, and that's the shooting in Chicago, the rally which is taking place, and parade down Michigan Avenue, even as we record this Mincing Rascals. And when I walked in, I saw your body chart with all 16 shots in, do the name for me now.
Laquan McDonald.
Laquan McDonald. Mm-hmm. And it's just devastating. It was interesting because when we did our episode last week, Kristen, you exclaimed at one point something that I've been playing back in my head ever since. And that was, as we were talking, and this was, remember, just before the video had been released, and we were talking about what we were going to learn and what the reaction would be. And you said, well, one thing is the police lie. And I thought that was an interesting statement because we hadn't seen the video yet. And we'd only read accounts. So presumably you were right. Boy, were you right. The police lied. They lied as much as you could about this story. There was no self-defense. If he was brandishing a knife, I don't know that they saw it. He didn't have a gun. The officer had no reason to fear for his life. And in fact, the distance between the two of them is the most startling aspect of the video to me, as opposed to the number of shots. We'll get to that in a minute. But he was gunned down with nobody near him. And he wasn't approaching anybody, and he wasn't running.
No.
The distance is what was startling to me. When he was walking down the street and I'm watching this, and I say, okay, now something's going to happen. And then he dropped.
Right.
What was your reaction the first time you saw the video?
I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I felt like the video was doctored. I still don't understand why there was no audio. There was, you really didn't see the other officers, squad cars. I thought we were going to see the dash cam from Jason Van Dyke's own car.
Right,
the
officer, we did not.
So it's kind of a surprise that you are getting the dash cam from another car, and then there are four other squads or five other squads that show up. So, I mean, my initial reaction was, he was walking away. It was completely unnecessary. This looked like murder. But the buildup to the tape, I thought, was greater than what we actually saw. You know, we didn't hear the 16 shots. We didn't see him lunging. I mean, at one point when this—
Because he didn't lunge.
But he certainly did not in that video. The original reports that— and some of this came from the police union officials, so not directly from the department, but the police union often kind of speaks for police and gets information directly from the scene. The information we had was that he was lunging at the squad car, that he was slashing tires of the squad car, that he was, throwing things at the windshield. So none of that unfolded.
Well, none of that unfolded in the video. Maybe he did prior and it's not on the video. But I think you're right about this looks, if not doctored, incomplete. There may be more damning stuff in the audio that we don't hear anymore. In the missing Burger King video files, which they went to a Burger King to see if they had video. They did. They took the video and they returned it. Stuff was missing. Why? Why don't we have more video from other squad cars? You know, and some of those are answerable questions, but the whole thing looks suspicious. And yet, even that video that we have, which you wish panned just a little to the left so that we could see more of the officer's actions, even the video that we have is beyond damning. I mean, it's not just about this case. This is the evidence that maybe the black community has been pointing to all along. That's dramatic, isn't it? But I mean, if you think that blacks don't get a fair shake in Chicago or elsewhere, here's Exhibit A.
Exactly. There are witnesses to this who were shooed away from the scene. So even as police were putting together their own reports, they didn't even interview witnesses who saw what happened. And according to there's a great story, which I'll talk about later. That's my recommendation in the Chicago Reporter. But there are about 50 police versus civilian shooting deaths per year in Chicago. Rarely, never. Does an officer get charged for that? And so I think that is the buildup that you see with the protests now going on Michigan Avenue right below us are things that the community sees all the time that we don't see. And you know the only reason that this is happening? Because a whistleblower a year ago who knew of the autopsy report that showed he was shot 16 times went to a reporter and said, they're giving you bad information. That was the start that got all of this rolling. And then once we learned there was a videotape, then the family, the attorney for the family saw it. They went to the city. The city gave them $5 million before the family even filed a lawsuit because they knew the video was this bad. And part of that lawsuit settlement agreement included confidentiality that the tape would not be released.
Well, that's what happens with these. I mean, we've had that's been the case with other shootings like this or other instances. You sign a confidentiality agreement, which enables the cops to, if not get away with it this time, maybe get away with it down the road, too. You know, and that's the way that happens. And I've expressed on this podcast before my frustration with that contract that they sign. I don't know what happens if they say, no, we're also going to talk about what happened. We're going to demand release of the video or whatever. Do they not get the $5 million then? I'm not sure. I heard some people roll their eyes at the family's willingness to take the $5 million. I don't have any problem with that, really. I'm upset about the fact that that maybe slows the process of discovery for the rest of us. But I always thought eventually this will come public, and they'll always have criminal satisfaction. So they have civil satisfaction, $5 million, and then charges will ultimately have to be filed against this guy. I wonder if we hadn't gone through this process, if they would be. You know what I mean?
Well, right. They weren't initially. And that's a question that is on my list of unanswered questions. When did this become a criminal case? Because it wasn't until after that whistleblower brought up the autopsy report and a reporter wrote about it. Then all of a sudden it became a criminal case with the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Before then, this would have probably been a police shooting case that moves through this independent police review authority board where they basically come to their own conclusion about what happened. Mm-hmm. And they do work with prosecutors. But generally, I think the last time an officer was charged in this city was 35 years ago.
Really? Well, I'm willing to believe that most of the time the cops are justified in shooting people. You know, I mean, don't you think the cops are the good guys?
I do. What I don't like is that there is a culture of protecting one another. Where all these other police officers who were on the scene that night, if they're the good guys and they saw this basic execution happen, where are they?
Yeah.
Why didn't they speak up?
I don't know. That's to me the thing, not to diminish this life, and I can't say that enough, but maybe the bigger deal here is that it's this culture of covering it up. Not just, I mean, like in some of the instances where there have been questionable shootings, at least it was how much of a threat did the person present? And we were wrestling and then we broke his neck or he suffered injuries from which he eventually died, or the gun was going off, but we were both holding it. And you can, in all of those cases, imagine that it was a judgment call in the flash of a second that maybe you understand how it happened. Here you don't have any of that. You just have them gunning him down like a dog in the street. And the other police officers at the time don't seem to reprimand him. In fact, as his body is lying there, 16 shots in him. They don't even come up to, I don't know if they needed to know if there was a pulse, but you know, they didn't render any medical assistance. And one of them comes up and kicks the gun away with his foot. Which seems so dismissive, right? The knife. What, is he going to lunge up and grab the knife and go after you guys? But no, they do that and then step back again. They treat him as though he's not a human being. And then where is, maybe it's too much to ask in this moment for some sort of compassion, but they don't treat him like a human being. And I probably shouldn't say this, Kristen, but you wonder if this was a white female or a white teenager or, I don't know, almost anything but a young teen black male, would their treatment of him been different? And would the treatment of the other officers been different? You know, it's just, it's the worst case scenario for that. I mean, all of those things come into play.
They do. And the timing of this, so the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson happened in August. This killing happened in October 24th. And those protests in Ferguson.
October 2014.
2014, yes. October 24th, 2014. I believe that's, yeah, it's definitely, yeah.
October. 14, yeah.
The protests in Ferguson were still ongoing. They started in August and they didn't really finish up until November. So this is all happening in the middle of that. And so to your point about good officers and the right of officers to shoot when they feel their life is threatened, completely agree with that. So in this case, I just believe that the timing of all of that, everything that was happening nationally, made them shut their mouths and hope that that video never got released, when what they could have done immediately was say, here's the video. This was, you know, this was a terrible thing that happened. The officer is going to be criminally investigated now, and just been honest from the beginning.
What else is on your list of unanswered questions?
So I still don't understand.
Where are the other good cops? Why didn't they react more?
Right.
Got
it. And you know what? This came from an anonymous tip. So maybe one of the cops who was at the scene initially was the tipster. We don't know. But, you know, who gave the initial information that this was, that he lunged and that he died of one gunshot wound to the chest? That's what was told. And that's what was reprinted in a lot of stories initially. Who said that? That person needs to be held accountable. Who arranged for the $5 million settlement with the family? This kid was 17 years old. He grew up basically in the foster system. So somebody took the time to track down his birth mother and arrange this $5 million check. Who did that? Was it the city? Was it Rahm's people? Was it the state's attorney? Was it, you know, the
enterprising
police department?
Attorney?
Right, right. I want to know who did that. And the recording, why is there no audio recording on the tape that was released or the four others that, by the way, they didn't release until the Tribune FOIA'd them, you know, a day after the incident. No audio. Where's that? What happened to the Burger King surveillance? Are we really supposed to believe that this surveillance video, it's missing, you know, 50 minutes of tape right when all of this happened? And why did Anita Alvarez, the Cook County State's attorney, sit on this for 13 months?
What's the mayor's role in all of this, too?
You know, I don't know that that's clear yet. I think his reaction has been really lackluster. I mean, he's trying to make this sound like this was one bad apple and we took care of it. No, you know what? Don't play us for chumps. This went on for 13 months. His reelection campaign was underway when this all happened. His primary was in February when all this happened. You're telling me that that didn't play into some of the decisions that were made?
Read John Cass's column on Thanksgiving Day about this, too, by the way, because he asked some of those same questions as well. Do you think there'll be backlash to the mayor? I mean, will there be consequences to the mayor, election consequences to the mayor?
I mean, he's safely reelected. The biggest consequences will be to Anita Alvarez, the state's attorney, because she has a primary in March. So she's up for reelection. She's going to be in big trouble. And I think this is going to put more pressure on the mayor to fire Gary McCarthy, the police superintendent.
Is this a police people thing as opposed to a black-white thing? I mean, it seems to me like everybody, regardless of their position, disposition, or demographic, everybody is outraged by this. Nobody is sitting there saying, although I run into this in Minneapolis, our version of this is a young man who died, quote-unquote, execution style. I've talked about this in our previous podcast. We're all waiting for the videotape. The videotape isn't being released until their investigation is over. In the meantime, Black Lives Matter is camping out on the 4th Precinct in Minneapolis Police Headquarters now with graffiti sprayed across it. And five people were shot the other night in violence stemming from this. And I'm like, God damn, what is in the video? Show us the video. And they have not yet. And so until that video is released, we have this existing flashpoint and nothing's going to happen until we see the video. Why am I telling you all of this now? I've lost my train of thought. But coming back to here,
I think part of the reason you're seeing, you were asking if it was a black-white thing.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And I think it's a little of both, but I agree with you. This has not so far turned into a hashtag Black Lives Matter.
Right.
Temperature.
And that's what I run into in Minneapolis, though, is that it is. It still feels a little black and white. It's like, well, if those kids wouldn't wrestle with the cop, or when the police say stop, you stop, and then bad things don't happen to you. And white people in the suburbs will say that. There are communities that will say that. Nobody is saying that about this one. I know the kid had PCP in his system, and he was brandishing a knife, 3-inch knife, that the entire Chicago police force was intimidated by. So there's that. But even with that, I don't hear many people saying that the man's actions justified the treatment he got.
Exactly. I think everyone understands that they were doing initially what they were supposed to be doing. They got a call about him. They were trying to corral him with their cars. And then this one officer jumps out and escalates the whole scene. But we also, because we're not hearing the audio of the cars that were on their way to the scene or anything, we don't really know.
What's up with that? Why has that audio disappeared from these videos?
The police chief says that it is supposed to be activated as soon as the blue lights turn on. And if it doesn't, or there are other ways where you can manually do it in the car. He sort of called it a technical difficulty, said that if officers didn't activate the equipment as they should have, they should be punished. But other than that, all the questions that we've asked about that go unanswered. In the Tribune story the next day, it was, no call, no comment from any of these entities.
Well, and I think that's what I think, not to diminish his life, but that's the damning thing here, is you have this sort of culture of duplicity where the other officers see that. And I don't know if they're able to just call Eric Zorn or Kristen McQuarrie or John Cass and say, hey, listen, just so you know, this thing went down and it's bad and we've got to do something about it. I don't know if that's a police officer should be saying that or doing that. It's hard to imagine that he could be doing that.
Well, but the police are out there every day trying to get people to report on bad activity. They are in the middle. Just this morning, they announced charges in the case of the little 9-year-old boy, Tashawn Lee, who was lured from an alley in November, or lured from playing basketball and shot execution style. They just announced charges today in that case. Do you think that's a coincidence? In the middle of the protest. But my point is, in that case, they leaned so hard on the community to snitch. Who did this? Who did this?
Well, the little boy's father didn't even want to cooperate originally, right?
Well, correct. But my broader point is the police don't want to snitch on each other either. They have very much of a closed culture where they do not rat each other out. And I think that also played into why the state's attorney kind of slow walked this whole case. It's tough for prosecutors who work alongside police officers every day and they respect each other so much to bring charges.
So now, ironically, the police are leading the Black Lives Matter rally. I'm looking as you and I record this on TV. And again, it starts just outside the studios where we're recording this podcast right now. But Black Lives Matter is marching and the cops are clearing Michigan Avenue the Friday after Thanksgiving so that they can be heard. That's funny, isn't it, that the cops are cooperating that way? Of course, they should. But I wonder going forward, what changes now? So Alvarez loses her job. McCarthy, does he lose his job? The mayor doesn't lose his job. The Jesse Jacksons of the world to me don't have a solution to this.
Mm-mm. No, in Ferguson, though, the Justice Department did come in and did a very top-to-bottom review of the department and tried to really pinpoint where there was institutional corruption built into the system and things that Ferguson could do to try to get past that. And so I wouldn't be opposed to seeing something like that here. Somebody outside has to take a look at this whole case and whatever institutionally is going on within the culture of the Chicago Police Department.
And I think the challenge for Black Lives Matter is to find a way to get the police, the civilian community, the Black community, the white community, all on the same page. And this disrupt campaign that they have been on across the country and for several months now gets attention. But I'm not sure that it does them as much good as they deserve. Just to piss people off and close roads and chant Black Lives Matter isn't enough. I live in Minneapolis, right? Pardon me for keep referencing it, but there's a very active Black Lives Matter movement there. And we've been on this campaign for over a year now. Last Christmas, for instance, they went to the Mall of America, the largest shopping center in the country, and they closed down a part of it the Saturday before Christmas. And it was really upsetting to people. when they have the Twin Cities Marathon, they threaten to block that. Imagine you're running the marathon. You know, pick the things that are near and dear to people's hearts. The Minnesota State Fair is a huge deal in Minnesota. And so they marched on the fair and closed gates, and some of the kids that came to play, their bands couldn't play. And they and their answer to this is, oh, really? So your day of shopping was inconvenienced while black lives are being gunned down in the street. Boo-hoo for you. And I get that. We all understand that intellectually. But that method doesn't work. You know, I mean, all I see them doing is this disrupt campaign, and I understand the outrage, but it's not going to marry the two sides together. And I don't see progress made until that happens. And I don't know how to do that. I don't know how that happens. I don't know how you get whites and blacks, police and civilians, old and young, all on page, and to get better treatment for people of color by the police. I mean, that's the end game here. And maybe disrupt and tick people off is just the first step of many. So this is a necessary inconvenience. But people aren't persuaded that these inconveniences are all that necessary. Now, when on Wednesday before Thanksgiving, they marched down Michigan Avenue. It was a five-minute deal. It wasn't that inconvenient. It, frankly, was surprisingly small, the outrage.
It was.
And I don't know how we're going to remember today, Friday, the day after Thanksgiving's rally, but it didn't look all that disruptive. The point of this speech is that they have to find a way to move forward, because I think right now they have a lot of eyes and ears on them who are like, okay, yeah, you're right. You're right. No argument anymore. That's bullshit. That's got to stop. So what do they do?
People within the movement have said that too. What is our end game here? And what's our strategy? And what do we want to come of this? So I think that's true. People who are involved in the movement itself acknowledge that you can't just run around and ruin stuff. I mean, we've been very lucky here so far. The protests have been largely peaceful.
You're quite right.
But they did, you know, at one point during the protest on Wednesday, they started ripping down lights from a couple of the Christmas trees that are decorated by the city. I mean, what is the point of that type of disruption? But I think you're right in that there has to be some sort of an end game, and people within the movement have acknowledged that too.
Eric Zorn and Steve Bertrand aren't with us this week. I missed their conversation, although it's kind of fun not to have them here, isn't
We're
it?
We're doing great. Just the two of us.
I'm sorry that one topic has so dominated this edition of The Mincing Rascals. Frankly, we could talk for another half hour. We won't. Is there anything else you want to add into this conversation today?
No, I think we've done a good job, and it deserved a good job the attention.
Of mm-hmm. what? You know, of just being like, I'll tell you, of being amazed. I mean, even in a city like Chicago where we know shit goes on, boy, I've cussed three times in this podcast.
I know. I need to catch up to you.
I know, but I mean, really, I'm amazed. You know, I am outraged. I'm really surprised at how indiscriminate that killing was, how unnecessary that was. And that image is not going to go away soon. I thought I was going to see more bam, 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 more gun action. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to be more taken by the bullets and the firing. But the startling thing to me was the distance mm-hmm. between the officer's gun. There's just no reason for that.
And just watching it, even though there was an audio, you could still sort of hear like muffled sirens. And you're watching, you know, it's this chase that goes on for, you know, 6 or 7 minutes. And then you see the figure, you see Laquan in the middle of the road. And it is just haunting. I mean, I was emotional about seeing, you know, here is a human being who's about to get killed right here in the middle of Pulaski
Laquan,
Road.
Stop. Stop.
You know, It's still just jarring. You're right to, and we don't know how often this happens around the country, but certainly, it is welcome for protests and the police. Like you were saying, they have cleared Michigan Avenue. They started off kind of leading the protesters in their SUV vehicles to kind of keep them safe as well.
Our recommendations are how we always close these podcasts. I just saw Spotlight.
I haven't seen it yet.
The movie of the Boston Globe uncovering in 2000, 2001, 1999 in there. The priest scandal in the Catholic Church started in Boston, or at least our discovery of this did. Yeah, what's lost on us, too, is that, and then right when they were like just getting to where they could publish, 9/11 happens, and it puts all of their reporting on it on hold. But they obviously eventually get back to it, and the movie is just breathtaking. It's just so good. Liev Schreiber's in there, and John Slattery from Mad Men, and Michael Keaton and Rachel McAdams. The cast is just and Mark Ruffalo is. People are going to. Not only is this going to be nominated for Best Picture, everybody I said is deserving of a nomination for something. I don't know who's going to be a lead or a supporting actor. It's not an upper. It's not the Hollywood treatment. There's not a scene where everybody throws up the paper in the newsroom and they cheer because we got them. You know, it's just a measured telling of that story. You never see an instance of abuse. It's just about the reporting of it. And it's just spectacular. I cannot recommend Spotlight enough. And speaking of movies, I'm going to give you one other recommendation. Every Thanksgiving, we did this yesterday. We saw it on Thanksgiving Day. My family and I go to a movie. We have for 15 years. We go to a movie, then we go to Lowry's. That's our Thanksgiving tradition. Just the four of us, Brenda and the boys and I. And we just love it. My son Griffin does a podcast. And if you download Anytime Minutes, his podcast this week is a description of the last 15 years of movies that we've seen and how that's come to be and what were the highs and the lows. So Spotlight's my movie recommendation, and the podcast besides this one of something called Anytime Minutes tells that story. What's your recommendation?
So Anytime Minutes is the name of the podcast where he talks about your family's tradition. Oh,
yeah,
that sounds so
recently.
Lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
So less lovely is my recommendation. The Chicago Reporter, in their most recent edition, chicagoreporter.com, has just the most concise and understandable, and it's not long at all, it's just a couple pages, explanation of what they describe as the police cover-up as it relates to Laquan McDonald. And it's just worth reading to kind of, if all these questions are swirling in your head, this is a good table setter to explain why this is such a big deal.
Hmm. Is that where you got the chart that's in front of
it
you?
It is. It has a picture of the autopsy and all the places where the bullets entered and exited his body.
It's not a photograph, but it's a chart, and you see just exactly how, not that you need any more proof, dramatic this was. Okay, so that's Kristen, a lot of fun. That's Kristen McQuarrie, who's an editorial writer and columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Thank you, Bob Ferguson. Thank you, Michael Heidemann and Kristen Decker, who produced this segment. This is John Williams, Steve Bertrand, and Eric Zorn, almost certainly back with us next week on The Mincing Rascals.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!